3. Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Okay, please be seated. Calling the second case this morning, Wisconsin Property Tax Consultants, Inc. versus Wisconsin Department of Revenue, 20AP485. Could I please have your appearances first?
Good morning, Your Honor. Plaintiff appellant petitioners appear by attorneys Don Millis and Carla Nettleton.
Good morning. All right, good morning. I want to also welcome Monticello High School from Greene County, Wisconsin. Could you please stand up for a moment? Oh, my goodness. Good group. It's nice to see you here today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I think we actually don't have anyone to greet you afterwards because we are running straight into a meeting. I can, and if time permits, depending on these arguments and how close we run, I'll run out and say hi real quick if you're still around. If not, we completely understand that as well. But nice to have you here. Welcome. Go ahead and have a seat. All right. 25 minutes followed by 30 minutes followed by 5 minutes in rebuttal. That's the lineup. Mr. Millis, go ahead and get started.
Thank you. May it please the court. The marshal came out and gave the warning to the students that they shouldn't fall asleep during this, among other things. Unfortunately, we have the wrong kind of case for that. We're talking about administrative rules and taxes, and I fall asleep when I talk about them. So,
try to stay awake.
I'll see what I can do.
That'll be Ann Walsh Bradley's job today. She'll wake you up if you start.
Okay,
I'll look forward to it, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Thanks.
This case really presents a single question, a question of law, we believe. Does the Tax Appeals Commission have jurisdiction to entertain declaratory judgment actions filed under Section 227.40, Paragraph 1, that seeks to determine whether the Department of Revenue has complied with the rulemaking requirements of Chapter 227, when that action is brought by a party that doesn't have standing to challenge an assessment issued by the Department of Revenue. The jurisdiction is the key. While primary jurisdiction itself is an issue of comity and discretion, it only applies if both the administrative agency and the circuit court have jurisdiction. Our point here is that the commission doesn't have jurisdiction. Neither the statute that enumerates the jurisdiction of the commission, that's section 73.01, parent 4, parent A, nor the statute governing rulemaking challenges, section 227.40, parent 1, give the commission jurisdiction over rulemaking challenges.
I want to take Counsel, I just want to clarify your argument to me. I thought you admitted that the Tax Appeals Commission could address whether something should have been promulgated as a rule. I thought you acknowledged that.
Here's what I think we acknowledged, that if a litigant who's been assessed by the Department of Revenue, either income franchise tax, sales tax, or property tax assessment, if they've been assessed and they choose to challenge appropriateness of the guidance that was issued by the department, perhaps it should have been issued as a rule. 227.40, parent 2, parent E, says you have to make that challenge there. It doesn't necessarily mean that the commission has the authority to engage in, determine or order the department to engage in rulemaking. I don't think that's within their purview. But the statute says you have to make that challenge there. That's what happened. I guess an analog is in the Metz case, where the Heritage Credit Union. Both those cases, the party was before an administrative body. They were obligated by 227.42E to make that challenge there. It's the same way the courts have said, for example, that the commission doesn't have the authority to invalidate a statute as being unconstitutional, but you have to make the challenge before you're obligated to make that challenge before the commission. That's what 227.40 provides. It doesn't say that the commission has the power to do it. It just says they have to do it.
So you think that the Tax Appeals Commission could not say, Department of Revenue, this needs to be promulgated as a rule, as part of a decision before someone, an interested party, if that was, in the language of the statute, duly challenged in the proceeding before.
Right.
The Tax
Appeals Commission. Don't think that they have that authority. And of course, that is, in a sense, that's an interesting case. It's not exactly this case, because this case involves parties who cannot come before the commission because they're not subject to assessment.
Yeah, I get that. I'm trying to narrow down your claim, because there were parts of your argument that, you know, talked about, you can't bring a declaratory judgment action, or could you do rulemaking, and then you have the standing question. And as I read your brief, I felt like it was narrowed down to this question of whether the primary jurisdiction doctrine is relevant or needs to be applied, whether there's concurrent jurisdiction, when one of the parties wouldn't have standing before an agency to make the claim we're making. But that's a little bit different than saying that, you know, the Tax Appeals Commission couldn't address rulemaking. And you're saying it doesn't matter that they could or can't? Are you saying they don't? Because I guess I'd like to know the answer to that question.
I don't believe that the Tax Appeals Commission has the authority to order the Department of Revenue to issue rulemaking. They can certainly say your guidance is inconsistent with the statute, which, in fact, recently in the case that was cited by the department, the commission recently, since the briefs came in, said that. I don't think they have the authority to order the department to engage in rulemaking. That's something that I think is reserved for a circuit court.
So when it's challenged, it's duly challenged in the proceeding, the validity of a rule or a guidance document, you're saying, what, they just drop a footnote and say, we hereby challenge this, or what? Like, how does this play out?
I think it's an issue. The legislature said it in the statute and said you have to make that claim before the administrative agency. I think it makes sense to do that. It puts the parties on notice. If there is an appeal to a circuit court could make that determination, could say yes. In fact, the 227.42 provides for rulemaking challenges in other types of actions other than an original action in circuit court just challenging rulemaking. And so sub E is the one that deals with administrative proceedings, and it says it requires you to make that challenge.
So, Attorney Millis, I hear what you're saying, but why would we decide that here? You're not under 2E.
I'm not.
You're under sub 1, and you're operating not as an entity that's been taxed, as you indicate, but as a group that has an interest, and you brought this under sub 1. So why would we go as far as you're asking?
I'm not asking about... That's not the thrust of our argument. We're responding to an argument from the department.
Okay, I just wanted to be...
Our concern is that our clients could never come under 2E because they're never subject to an assessment. The issue here is the appropriateness or the jurisdiction of the ability of a circuit court. Let's put it this way. The lack of jurisdiction of the commission should indicate that the circuit court should have taken our challenge to the lack of rulemaking by the department, because primary jurisdiction didn't exist, because the commission didn't have jurisdiction.
Right. They shouldn't have dismissed it. They should have decided it, including issues of standing and all other issues in the case.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Fair enough. So as I indicated earlier, the department had, in its brief, had mentioned this test case that was winding its way through the commission at approximately the same time that dealt with the merits of the MTP exemption. The commission, I can report to you, split the baby. It rejected the department's claim that exemption didn't apply to manufacturers, but it didn't apply to all MTP. I just want to point that out so the record's clear.
Mr. Mills, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
So your argument really focuses on that the section of 227, and I'm curious. I just want to. You're focused on 227 40 sub 1, and I'm curious as to why you didn't ask for a rule to be promulgated under 227.12 sub 4 and or 227.12 at all, because it says 227.12 sub 1 says, unless the right to petition for a rule is restricted by statute to a designated group or unless the form of procedure for a petition is otherwise prescribed by statute, municipality, an association, which is a representative of a business or professional group, or any more than five persons having an interest in a rule may petition an agency requesting it to promulgate a rule. So why is your argument not under that section of the statute?
We did not petition there. To be honest, there were negotiations with the department. We attempted to suggest that maybe a rule should be adopted. There was a change in administrations. There was a hope that the result will be different. We felt that that was futile. We felt that it was more important or more expeditious to go the 227.40 route, which is the right of, or sub one, which is the right of the parties. So that was all.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the I think the delay here in this case with the other case going on is a good reason why rulemaking makes sense. Recall, we're dealing with the Tax Appeals Commission, and appeals is important. You can only get to the Commission of Assessments issued against you. There are certain parties, organizations, you have our organizations, you have other types of advocacy groups that cannot appear before the Commission. They don't have jurisdiction because they're never subject to an assessment. But it's important that when the law changes or when the guidance changes by the department, that you can have a prompt resolution of that. If the department changes its guidance, let's say the example I was thinking of is, they could change the definition of candy in the sales and use tax, which might mean that Girl Scout cookies would be subject to tax. I've been eating too many Girl Scout cookies lately, and they've been omnipresent everywhere I go and all that, and so I'm complicit in that. But let's say that they decide to do that. And let's say that my daughter's in the Girl Scouts, and he has to decide, do we collect and remit sales tax, or do we think that it's not appropriate, and we roll the dice? The department has 4 years to issue that assessment. Wouldn't it make more sense for an organization like the Badgerland Girl Scouts to file an action in circuit court rather than even petition the department to say, look, you can't issue this guidance without a rule. And if the court agrees, that means that the guidance is stricken and you involve other parties. The value of rulemaking, it's different than just having the commission or a court say that the department can't do that. Rulemaking is itself a benefit. Often guidance that the department or any agency offers is done typically in the shadows. I mean, there's internal debate within the agency. Sometimes a few stakeholders are consulted. But typically the first time that the public finds out about guidance that an agency issues is when it's published. In the department's case, maybe in the quarterly bulletin. In other agencies, it may be FAQs that appear on their website. When you engage rules, you involve the public. You involve other parties. You can't start rules without getting a scope statement approved by the governor. Those are published in the administrative register, so the public is aware of it. There's a series of steps that goes on. You involve necessarily the governor, the public, and the legislature. And those are all good things. And that's why we should remain vital and have the ability under 227.40 sub 1 for interested parties to compel agencies to engage in rulemaking. That's what this case is really about.
Counsel, I'm still trying to get my mind around precisely what what the distinguishing features of your argument are here. Because in some of your briefing talks about, is it that the Tax Appeals Commission, can't make a statement or a ruling that something should have been promulgated as a rule? Is it that, or is it focus on your standing question? And so let me just frame it in a different way here. What exactly are you asking us to hold? And I could see that coming a lot of different ways. Are you asking us to hold that if someone could not by themselves, as an interested party, bring a case before an agency like your clients in this case, the primary jurisdiction doctrine doesn't apply? Are you asking us to hold that when it comes to promulgating administrative rules, whether an agency should, guidance document should have been promulgated or constitutes an unpromulgated rule, that is something that is not subject to the primary jurisdiction doctrine or under certain circumstances, not others. What exactly are you wanting us to say about this?
I'm saying that, at least with respect to this case, if you have a party that is not subject directly to the jurisdiction of an agency or through an appellate means through a supervisory body like the, I guess you could have other commissions, but the Tax Appeals Commission, that body can go to circuit court under 22740 sub 1 and pursue a rules case, whether it's challenging a rule that was made improperly or challenging guidance that should have been made as a rule.
So
and they're not subject to primary jurisdiction. That's all we're saying.
So focuses on standing, right? Is that it? That if because your clients could not go to the Tax Appeals Commission and get the relief they want, primary jurisdiction, or the relief that, you know, they're looking for here, or get a statement about whether rulemaking should have occurred or not, the primary jurisdiction shouldn't apply. Is it the standing question?
I don't think it's – I guess I just differ briefly. And
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't think it's standing. I think these entities have standing to bring it because 227 talks about interested parties. You don't have to actually be threatened. And there's we have a long history in this case in the state of allowing organizations from Environmental Decade to the Wisconsin Hospital Association, there's a case involving that, where organizations can bring actions on behalf of their stakeholders or members. So I don't think it's an issue of standing. I think they can do it. It's an issue of whether or not primary jurisdiction should apply in those cases, because here we just don't think the commission has, under just the operation of law, the statutes, the commission doesn't have jurisdiction over those claims because, one, primarily, those parties couldn't get there.
Counsel, that's just, it's muddled to me. I don't know if it's muddled to you. But you're really saying the parties couldn't get there. I'll take you at your last words. And why couldn't they get there? Your answer is because they don't have standing.
Let me clarify. Let's use my example of the Girl Scouts, okay? Well, let's use a better – let's talk about Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. They've got members who are manufacturers, okay? The manufacturers file manufacturing returns with the state. They are assessed every year by the Department of Revenue. And one of the issues is what personal property is exempt, okay? And so they are – every year the Department of Revenue issues assessments against every manufacturer saying your property is worth this much, and by the way, we think that this machine that you said was exempt is taxable, now it's worth $1 million or $100,000 or whatever it is, you got to pay taxes on it. Those members, they have standing because they're served with a notice of assessment. They can file an objection. It goes to the Board of Assessors. They can appeal that.
Totally agree. They have standing.
But WMC does not.
They
don't have any machinery. They are not subject to an assessment.
Aren't you saying, but does not have standing? I mean, isn't that the correlation?
They don't have standing to appeal to the Tax Appeals
Commission.
That's
what you're saying.
Right. But they do have standing to represent their interests in a 227.
Yeah. Your argument is, as I understand it, that the Tax Appeal Commission cannot handle the issue because WMC would not have standing to present that issue before the Tax Appeal Commission. Is that what you're saying?
That's certainly part of it.
Okay.
And I would also say there's a timing issue involved.
Okay, forget timing right now because that's a new thing you're introducing.
Okay.
But in terms of standing, that's your argument, standing, that they can that this entity can do a 227, right?
Right.
But they can't go to the Tax Appeal Commission. If it were one of your individual members who was being assessed, then that's fine. That can go to the Tax Appeal Commission. Am I correct on that?
They could appeal their assessment to the commission. Yes, they could.
That's right.
Why does this have to be connected to standing? I mean, that's what I – when I first asked you the first question, my corollary to that was, and then they can determine standing. I don't know if WMC can bring this or not, frankly. I haven't given it a lot of consideration, because I don't think it's the central issue. I think the only issue is who hears it. So whether WMC can bring it or not is irrelevant. They are bringing something under 227.40 sub 1, and the only question is that something that they bring, that declaratory judgment, belong in circuit court, or does it belong in the Tax Appeals Commission such that primary jurisdiction doctrine comes into play? And you're asking us to hold that it is the circuit court and that it should not have been dismissed for purposes of primary jurisdiction in the Tax Appeals Court, right?
Exactly.
So who cares if, I mean, standing doesn't matter.
I totally agree with you. The issue is, should anyone, whether it's Environmental Decade or an advocacy group or business group, be allowed to bring an action challenging the lack of guidance by the Department of Revenue or lack of rulemaking by the Department of Revenue on behalf of its members? And even though its members could challenge it if they were assessed, why should they have to wait until 4 years down the road?
Yes, but you still phrase it in terms of standing. You don't need to phrase it in terms of standing. When someone does bring a 227.40 sub 1 claim, it does primary jurisdiction require that it be sent back into the Tax Appeals Commission, regardless of whether they can bring it in front of their members, of whether they were taxed individually? They could bring it there. That's what I see the narrow issue is.
I understand, but the problem is, let's say we've got a decision. Let's say the decision of the circuit court stands. Now we've got WMC and WPTC are sitting here. How do they pursue their claims? They don't. They can't go. They can file a petition with the commission. They can't.
They may not be able to. Again, back to standing. What I see us doing, if we determine that the circuit court was incorrect and that this belongs in front of circuit court, it is then up to the circuit court to hear your argument about standing and whether or not the WMC can ever bring such a claim.
Right.
And maybe they say you can't, and maybe they dismiss it, and that's the end.
But again, I don't think there's ever been a challenge to WMC's right to bring it. The issue has always been, is the discretionary doctrine of primary jurisdiction appropriately engaged by the circuit court?
I'm going to jump into the fray here because I feel like what is a very simple, discrete issue is being confused by issues of standing. Your issue is that you have brought to us is whether or not the Tax Appeals Commission has concurrent jurisdiction with the circuit court over the rulemaking challenge that you have brought. I read the statute, and I guess I'm going to put my cards on the table because I see that there is no concurrent jurisdiction. The statute speaks in terms of the exclusive means of judicial review of the validity of a rule or guidance document being brought in the circuit court that has venue over such a claim. So regardless of whether a taxpayer could bring a claim under a different statute. The Department of Revenue says it's 227.402E. You agree. A taxpayer could bring a rulemaking challenge under that statute. That's not the issue before us. The issue is who has jurisdiction, and your argument is under 227.40 sub 1. It is only the circuit court. So there are no standing issues, correct?
We agree. Both 227.40 sub 1 and 73.014A, those are the substantive tax areas that the department or the commission has jurisdiction. 227 is not one of them.
And if there is no concurrent jurisdiction, we don't need to get into whether jurisdiction is primary or not, because we don't even get there unless there's concurrent jurisdiction, which there is not. That's your argument, right?
I agree.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I assume my time is almost
up. Ben, why do you have, I'm just pulling up page 25 of your brief, and I'll tell you what I did. I couldn't quite understand why, as I read your argument, so much seemed to rely on standing, and the Court of Appeals didn't, to my recollection, even mention the word standing. And you have on the top of page 25 how you distinguish, I think, the other cases, and you say, and none of them involve litigants who lack standing to directly challenge an administrative agency's actions. These cases do not support the circuit court's decision. And so standing was of some moment to you in your brief. That's just one place I picked right now. So what is it?
We addressed that because those are rationale adopted by the Court of Appeals. So we felt
did the Court of Appeals mention the word standing anyplace in the opinion?
I think you caught me on there. I don't know.
The reason that's important, though, is because what the circuit court did here is to close the door to the courthouse on your claim. The circuit court said, no, I'm not exercising jurisdiction. You can go to the Tax Appeals Commission. But, of course, your clients cannot go to the Tax Appeals Commission because they, I'm really hesitant to say it, don't have standing under 227.402E. So the claim you brought can only be heard by the circuit court.
That's exactly right. And the distinction between the Sawicka case, and I can't pronounce that right, that's the main
None
case.
Of us can.
But in that case, the change in the law wouldn't have changed the result, because in that case, that was a taxpayer who had a notice of assessment against them, and they brought a separate action. That was... And even though the legislature has narrowed the scope considerably since then, they would still be obligated to make whatever claim there. And of course, that was not a rulemaking claim. They wanted a separate action, declaratory judgment action. It wasn't rulemaking. It was just on the merits. So, I'm almost done, but I think I've concluded my remarks. Thank you very much.
I think so, too, but I'm just trying to figure out why it went to green and then yellow.
I just noticed yellow flashing two or three times, but I'm right. I'm good.
We have a lot of colors today.
I think you're done, though, right? You have 20 seconds.
You can save it for rebuttal.
I'll save it for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. Based on the first argument, I think it is a narrow issue here, which is about the primary jurisdiction doctrine. So the question is whether the Circuit Court correctly applied the primary jurisdiction doctrine, which requires that the administrative body also have jurisdiction over the issue. And so
Do you get to primary jurisdiction if there isn't concurrent jurisdiction?
That's what I was trying to say, is that there needs to be jurisdiction over the issue, concurrent jurisdiction over the issue, so the agency and the court both have jurisdiction over the issue. So that's the first step, and that's what the one question presented here in the petition for review was.
But would you concede that the Tax Appeals Commission does not have jurisdiction to consider the claim that has been brought by these petitioners?
By these petitioners, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And so I think we're not in dispute that that's true, but then also that any member of the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce who does have property and has this exemption applied allegedly erroneously would be able to bring such a claim before the Tax Appeals Committee.
So what principle of law are you relying on to close the courthouse doors to an association who wishes to bring a rulemaking challenge in circuit court?
Well, I have to say that I don't think this is closing the door. The primary jurisdiction doctrine is a doctrine of discretion. Circuit courts have discretion as to whether they want to apply it or not. So the courthouse door is open, and the party has to show to the circuit court that they should decide this issue rather than deferring. And here the circuit court made a decision to defer because there was currently pending before the
tax. But defer to what? If these petitioners cannot go to the Tax Appeals Commission, you would agree they have nowhere else to go, right, except to the appellate courts.
True.
To reverse the decision. How do you get around the language in 227.40(1), which says the exclusive means of judicial review of the validity of a rule or guidance document shall be an action for declaratory judgment brought in the circuit court?
Well, it says except as provided in sub 2 before that. And sub 2 is where the manufacturers get the ability to bring these claims before
but the... But not the association.
True, but the association, not to bring up standing again, but their standing to bring this claim is associational standing. And the associational standing is based on their members who are manufacturers who own the property subject to this exemption. So in essence, the association is in a better place than the... Because it's undisputedly... would apply, the primary jurisdiction doctrine would apply to any individual manufacturer who tried to bring this declaratory judgment action. Now, when they band together, form a group called, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, or manufacturers who don't like the department's tax exemption interpretation, Now, the primary jurisdiction doctrine would not apply because those people, because they don't even own property that's affected by this exemption, they can't bring a claim before the commission because they aren't actually individually affected by the allegedly improper guidance that the department issued. So that's our position, is that when there's an association that's bringing this claim, whose standing, whose interest in this is based on members who are able to bring those claims under sub 2, that the primary jurisdiction doctrine should apply, and that the circuit court can exercise discretion either to hear the case or to not. In other cases, I think a circuit court would hear the case, and it would be efficient to hear a rulemaking challenge. In this case, it really didn't make much sense because the problem with the guidance was just that they didn't like the interpretation of the law.
Counsel, you know, the primary jurisdiction doctrine is, as you said, it's not law anywhere, right? This is a doctrine of judicial restraint. It's premised upon respect for the other branches of government. It's premised upon efficient judicial use of resources. The idea is, if the legislature prescribes a process for adjudicating claims in an agency, it makes sense before the courts answer the question to let, out of respect for the legislature and the executive branch, for them to do the jobs that have been laid out here. At least that's my understanding of it, and I'm happy to have you add any other color to it. So I guess I'm a little having a hard time understanding your argument that you make in your briefing that, you know, this is sort of a backdoor kind of getting around the issue. Because there's nothing really to get around. I guess part of my response is, you know, so what? So what if an association can go to court and get an answer on whether rulemaking, you know, whether an agency hasn't complied with the law? You know, the primary jurisdiction doctrine is about ensuring we don't have duplication of resources and doing it the legislative prescribed way. But as you've really acknowledged, WMC and the other parties here, the petitioners, can't get the answer that they want. So what? How does the primary jurisdiction doctrine, being precisely the more equitable doctrine that you have, I think, correctly identified it as, why are those purposes served by it here? Because what we're really talking about is the scope of the primary jurisdiction doctrine. We don't need to treat this as some complicated legal test.
I agree. It is like a equitable kind of consideration by circuit courts to look at different factors as to whether they'd want to exercise jurisdiction or not. I think it makes sense here because, it was brought as both a rulemaking challenge, a statutory interpretation challenge, and a constitutional challenge. But essentially, really, this is about the statutory interpretation. So the way this came up is WMC says, we interpret what we're calling the non-manufacturing exemption basically as covering all property that wasn't currently covered by an existing exemption. The department wrote a letter back, probably, maybe not smartly, because now it is challenged as a rule, but saying no, that we don't agree with that interpretation. And that guidance, if you strike that letter, I mean, the statute still says what it says. And so the issue here is, like, what does that mean? And I think the circuit court rightly saw there was many cases before the Tax Appeals Commission raising that issue, including the Masters Gallery case, which counsel mentioned, which has now been petitioned for review to the circuit court. So this statutory interpretation question will be decided by the courts. DOR is not issuing rules trying to usurp that role or anything. It's just whatever the statute means, that's what it's going to mean, and it's going to apply to certain pieces of equipment or not. And that will be, it makes more sense to determine that in the course of an actual case involving real equipment subject to these exemptions than it does in kind of a hypothetical situation, which is what, like this hypothetical forklift, which was an issue in the case. So that was like the genesis, I think, of the circuit court's decision, the court of appeals decision. Now, I think a court could say, well, actually, in this case, it makes sense to hear this now. If there were no cases pending before the Tax Appeals Commission at the time, I think it makes much more sense for the circuit court to say, let's just address this issue now, we'll get it over with. Or maybe a pure issue of law that was like not tied with any facts, you know, it would make more sense to do it there. So I think it, and I would just say that our approach allows that circuit court to still do that determination, whereas ruling in favor of the taxpayer would say, actually, the circuit court, you can't do that. It you have to decide that case. So,
Go ahead. Just
you seem to indicate parenthetically in your response that maybe the letter was sent, unfortunately, that's my word, not yours. Do you think if your closing counsel prevails that it'll be the position of the department not to issue or not to respond to letters from associations, because otherwise that end runs the TAC?
Yeah, I mean, it does put the agencies in a little bit of a difficult position in that you would like to perhaps offer guidance to the regulated parties about how, and this was a new exemption, it had just been passed. So I think even if they go through rulemaking, that's probably a several-year process before you get a rule, and there's been several tax assessments in that time frame. So there's a kind of a balance between offering that guidance but then also potentially subjecting yourself to litigation as that it's an unpromulgated rule. And so, yeah, I think, you know, if we lose, it might cause the department not to issue respond to letters like that quite as easily. And I would just note that it's not necessarily restraining the agency if you order them to go into rulemaking, because rulemaking then has the force of law, whereas here what the Department of Revenue is saying is the statutory language just governs. So once this is decided in cases, what that meaning is will be determined by the courts as applied to specific pieces of equipment, and that will be how the department applies the rule or applies the statute going forward.
One of the things I saw in the lower court decisions is that they, you know, you had three claims. There were three claims that were brought at first, right? You have the, you know, is this properly interpreting the statute? You've got the constitutional question. And then you've got this, is this an unpromulgated rule? The only one we have left is the unpromulgated rule question.
Yes.
And so we don't really have a question of how it applies in a given factual, you know, scenario before us. It seemed like the lower courts, the trial court in particular, maybe sort of lumped everything together as statutory interpretation, I guess. But whether something, you know, is meant to interpret it, whether it's some, you know, the letter is meant to interpret it and have the effect of law and all the other requirements of a rule isn't necessarily the same thing as actually interpreting it.
Yeah, I mean, and I don't think the department ever said that the letter has the force of law. But I think it came up that way, and opposing counsel said it in his presentation, that the guidance was inconsistent with the statute. I mean, that's always really been the underlying issue here in this case all along. I mean, I think if the department's letter had said, yes, we agree with your interpretation, I very much doubt we would have an unpromulgated because it's really just a disagreement about what the statute means.
Counsel, it was my sense in the briefs and even some of the oral argument here that we're a little loosey-goosey with regard to the words claim and issue. And I want to just drill on that for a bit. Is it your position, first of all, what's the issue?
Well, here I think that the issue is whether, I mean, in the remaining claim, it's whether this letter was an unpromulgated rule.
Okay, that's the issue. And is that issue, that subject matter issue, is that issue something that the TAC can decide as well as a circuit court?
Our position is yes, I mean, brought by an appropriate party, leaving that aside, but just focusing
that's
on
right.
Issue, yes, and I think that's there in 227.40 sub 2, and it's also in 7301.4a, which makes the Tax Appeals Commission the final authority for the hearing and determination of all questions of law, in fact, arising under, and then one of those is 70.995 sub 8, which is the statute where manufacturing assessments can go to the Tax Appeals Commission.
So, if I'm just made to finish this loop. So, it's the issue, the subject matter is something that there is concurrent jurisdiction over. The question here, it seems to me, is whether, as advanced in part by your opposing counsel, whether or not this claim can be maintained.
Yeah, and I think that's
the issue, but the claim.
Yeah, the case law speaks in terms of issue, so that's the way we've briefed it. To the extent, if it's viewed as the issue in general, like you just discussed, then yes, there's concurrent jurisdiction. If it's viewed as issue brought by this party, then the Tax Appeals Commission would not have jurisdiction over
issue brought by a party is another way of saying a person's claim or a party's
claim.
Right?
True.
Yeah.
So I don't hear you disagreeing much with opposing counsel. No, I think he agrees that you could bring this under the tax commission if you were a member and not if it wasn't WMC and you were an individual who was having or manufacturer who was being taxed, right? So you're not really disagreeing.
No, I don't think we're disagreeing on like who can bring what in what courts or what administrative agencies, just what to make of that and whether the primary jurisdiction doctrine would apply to allow the circuit court to defer to the tax appeals commission.
So what do you want our holding to be then?
I think the holding would be that the Tax Appeals Commission does have concurrent jurisdiction over the issue of some sort of guidance or whether something's an unpromulgated rule.
In certain circumstances?
Well, just over that issue, and since that's the issue involved in their claim, then the primary jurisdiction doctrine applies.
Well, it depends on what you do with the issue. You're making a great big combination of issues, in my view. I think what he's saying is they could bring it, yes, but I don't think he's ever argued that the Tax Appeals Commission has the authority to decide whether DOR correctly applied rulemaking proceedings in the matter that's before us.
Well, that's why they're the final authority for the hearing and determination of all questions of law and fact arising under 7.9958, and that's the section that where there's an if a manufacturer has an issue of law or fact that affects its property tax assessment.
It doesn't, though. You see, that's where you get sideways with opposing counsel. WMC has nothing that's going to be taxed.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So really, we're looking at WMC and the other entity that's similarly situated with no equipment. So why shouldn't the court just focus on the issue, which is, was the primary jurisdiction doctrine properly applied by the circuit court? Isn't that all we're supposed to be looking at? And if we say no, it goes back to the circuit court. If we say yes, then it does something else, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
So is your position that any time an issue could be brought by a manufacturer, the group or an entity would be precluded from bringing that issue in court?
No, not precluded at all. They can bring it. It's a discretionary doctrine. And so what it would do is allow the circuit court to determine, is this something that's more appropriately brought before an administrative agency? Here, the Tax Appeals Commission. Here, the circuit court decided that it was. There are many instances where I think the circuit court would decide that it's not. So it's not an all or nothing rule. Everyone can still bring these claims, and it's up to the discretion of the circuit court to decide where it's most appropriately heard. I mean, like I said, if there had been no current cases before the Tax Appeals Commission, then it seems like more of an appropriate time to hear it when there's many cases going on that are raising the same issue. You're going to have
they both have to have jurisdiction, counsel.
True.
Okay, so if they both don't have jurisdiction over the issue, then I don't see how the circuit court can ever, in the exercise of its discretion, shut the door to the courthouse.
No, that's true, and I was just responding to the Chief Justice's question, which was like, would my position shut the door to the courthouse? And I'm saying no, it would not.
Oh, okay, I just misunderstood. Thank you.
You're saying no, it would not because they could choose to dismiss it or not, but what do you make of the language? And I know it says except as provided in sub 2. We're not under sub 2. But the next part is the exclusive means of judicial review shall be, and it's in circuit court. So, I mean, the way you're saying it is, in a way, like, yeah, the circuit court can dismiss it or they cannot dismiss it, but what does that do with the exclusive means language?
Well, it says except for as provided, so there's
Well, right,
two
but
means.
It doesn't fit under two. We all agree that WMC doesn't fit under
if
two.
If it's party-based, that the party itself bringing the claim has to be able to bring the case before the agency, then there wouldn't be concurrent jurisdiction. We're saying it shouldn't be party-based, especially when the party at issue is getting its standing, its interest in the case through its members who are able to do that.
So you seem to be mixing standing with it, and that to me is like whether or not the circuit court's going to say they have standing or not is another question. It's not the question.
We've never contested standing, but they have standing because they have manufacturing members who are affected by this exemption, however you interpret it.
But you're saying that because of concurrent jurisdiction, it could be dismissed from circuit court.
Yes.
But it's not really concurrent jurisdiction as to this agency. The way you get to concurrent jurisdiction is you sort of weave in this notion that as a manufacturer could be heard on this issue, there's concurrent jurisdiction. You're really trying to aim our focus on, can this issue be brought in two places by different parties? And if so, then if it's kicked out of circuit court by the agency, they have to live with that and see what the determination is by an individual manufacturer.
I believe that's true.
Yeah. Well, how can that be that a party can be relegated to another party's litigation of an issue when they'd have no ability to really meaningfully participate in that litigation?
Well, I think when the party who it has to defer to is its own members by which it's getting the interest in the case.
There's no language in 227.40 sub 1 that removes the exclusive means of judicial review language from associational challenges, right?
No, I don't believe so.
In a practical level, you are sort of shutting the door to anybody who, to any entity that does not have a viable tax appeals commission claim. Because if unless a court determines not to apply the primary jurisdiction doctrine in its discretion, but as a practical matter, that does sort of shut the door if a court decides to apply it. And the only time a rule could be challenged then, potentially, is if you have a circuit court that doesn't want to answer the question or something like that, decides not to apply the primary jurisdiction doctrines through that agency route. So it does seem to limit the world of challenges.
Well, yeah, it would depend, though, I guess, with just respect with the DOR guidance. This could apply to across all agencies here. So I think with the DOR guidance, some of those things go through the Tax Appeals Commission, some of them will not. So it wouldn't be a universal rule with respect to all Department of Revenue guidance.
Sure.
But I just don't like the phrase shutting the door, because it's like you can go in the circuit court, I think, with kind of a better, if given better reasons for addressing the non-promulgated rule claim, it would address those. And maybe just to address some of the, there's been some like that this is inefficient, to do this. But I mean, several of the, large administrative rule cases in the past few years have gone through the administrative agency decision up through the courts, like Lamar Advertising, Outdoor Advertising went through the administrative process through DOT and DHA. The Clean Wisconsin cases from last term went through the DNR permit procedure all the way up. So these issues can be raised in that way. Lamar is basically the same. I'm not exactly the same, but it's an unpromulgated rule type claim. So you can raise those claims before agencies and get to the courts.
How broad is this case? I guess I approach it, the Tax Appeals Commission is a unique entity. I didn't see the ramifications of this case necessarily blending or going over to different agencies, DHS or DNR or any other agency, because of the unique status of the Tax Appeal Commission.
Well, I think it would depend on the opinion the court wrote. I mean, something that was tied to the Tax Appeals Commission's jurisdiction would obviously be limited to that. Something that was more expansive could apply to other agencies, because while the Tax Appeals Commission is somewhat unique, it is just an administrative body that's making a determination of things that then can be reviewed in courts through Chapter 227 review. So I think the decision here could apply to other agencies as well, depending on the reasoning and like what the scope of the decision is.
Your argument, if I heard you correctly, to Justice Dallet's question about holding, was that because rulemaking is an issue that could be handled by the agency as a general matter, the primary jurisdiction doctrine should apply. There is concurrent jurisdiction in that context. That could be pretty broad. I mean, that would suggest that anytime an agency could address rulemaking at all, as a matter, which most agencies probably have some vehicle for doing that, that effectively limits the ability for an entity from going to court, I guess, in this way.
It could. I mean, I think there's also, like, the exhaustion doctrine and, like, the, you know, you have to follow doctrine. So this applies more to organizations who aren't, like, directly affected. For example, like, a DNR permittee who, or someone who is subject to DNR groundwater permits or something, and they just they're in the permitting process and go to court. I mean, that's different, you know. So I don't know that it would affect those type of cases, or even an individual manufacturer here who, like, brought this case on its own. I mean, I think it's just a different circumstance, because I think they, you know, that person could go to the Tax Appeals Commission and bring that unpromulgated rule claim. So I think it's probably more might affect, depending on how the opinion is worded, is like organizations who are doing this on behalf of regulated entities subject to the agency.
What about individuals? Your friend on the other side raised the example of, I believe it was Legal Aid Society, bringing a claim under 227.40 sub 1 on behalf of or in the interests of their individual low-income clients with respect to, I think the example given was the earned income tax credit. Is it the department's position that a low-income taxpayer individually would have to go before the Tax Appeals Commission in order to have that rulemaking heard if the circuit court said, I'm not exercising jurisdiction here?
I'm not exactly sure of the process of how, like, an income taxpayer would do that. I can't say. I think it's possible, depending how the statutes work and what it says you have to do. I would say that to the extent there's something like that, that is a factor that weighs in favor of the circuit court exercising jurisdiction. If there was some, I don't know that the department has any guidance on earned income tax credits. I think it's a federal tax credit. But I think I don't know for sure how that process works, because it depends on how, like, what that person is supposed to do before the commission. I know certain tax exemptions and things go to the Tax Appeals Commission, so it's possible that's the case. I don't know for sure. And for example, there's the Girl Scout example as well. I mean, if there was, like, some new guidance and the Girl Scouts wanted to challenge that, I think our position is to not stop that. And to the extent there was no cases pending before the commission, and there was, like, as Mr. Miller said, there might be, like, 4 years before some audit happens. That's a factor that weighs in favor, and the circuit court could decide the case. Frankly, the department sometimes might not raise this issue and might decide it is better to just hear it in circuit court. I mean, this case was just a little unique in that it was being fought out over many, many cases in the Tax Appeals Commission. And ultimately, there will be one decision, maybe from this court, maybe from the Court of Appeals, the circuit court, about what the tax exemption means. And that will be the end of this whole issue. So. And I think I've covered what I wanted to cover, but if there's other questions, I have a little bit of time left, so I'd be happy to answer questions.
I think you're all set. Thank you. Mr. Mills?
Thank you. May it please the court. I just want to address 2 points. First of all, it was more than a letter. There's instructions on the department's website. There's instructions in the form, that form MP every year, that reasserts the department's position on this. Second, and I think I disagree strongly with counsel, that these issues are all boiled up into the fact that WMC, like, the interpretation that the department had of this exemption. To be sure, we didn't. But rulemaking is a different remedy. Rulemaking is a remedy in and of itself. In my example of the Girl Scouts, you could say that the department's forced to do rulemaking. The rule may come out not the way we want it. The rule could say, yeah, you got to pay sales tax on it. That's a different issue. Rulemaking is something that our clients feel very strongly about. The department, again, if you compare the administrative register of DNR and other agencies to the Department of Revenue doesn't issue a lot of rules. And so this is part of an effort to compel them to issue rules and stop relying on guidance. As I indicated before, rulemaking is done in the open. When you have guidance that's based on rules or that's contained in rules, in my experience, mm-hmm. it's better guidance because you have more people involved in the process. You have the public, you have notice, you have the governor's office, and you have the legislature involved. And that's a better result. And so it is a separate issue. And perhaps it would have been wiser in retrospect to only bring a rulemaking claim in circuit court and not bring in the other claims about the constitutionality of the guidance or whether the guidance matched the statute. That may have been as I sit here today, might have done that.
Counsel, let me make sure I understand in the few moments you have left. If brought by a private manufacturer, I understand your position that the Tax Appeal Commission can address the issue of rulemaking. Now, they can't order rulemaking, but they can address the issue. They have jurisdiction to decide whether or not rulemaking should have been done.
You know, the language in 227.40 sub 1 seems to suggest that it's the court's jurisdiction. Then you have the exception in 2E.
So what's your position?
That's let's put it this way.
We don't have a lot of time left.
What's your position? As a former member of the Tax Appeals Commission, I would be surprised if someone were to say, you can decide that the commission was or the department was wrong and they should have issued a rule. I mean, we would decide all the time whether the rule was consistent with the statute or the guidance was consistent with the statute. Happens all the time. Well, probably not as often as taxpayers want, but it happens from time to time. I think I would be surprised by that. Now, if this court were to decide that the commission could do that, there are probably a lot of our clients that would say, yay, that's a good idea.
What
but we're trying to look at the statute.
Counsel, what is your position?
Well, I think our position...
What is your argument? Tax Appeal Commission have jurisdiction to decide the issue of rulemaking if brought to decide the issue, not order, if brought by a private manufacturer?
No.
They don't. I heard you arguing earlier that they did.
No, I think you have to bring it as a procedural matter if you're the manufacturer because the statute requires you to.
Okay.
And then a circuit court in one of those, because a 2E is one of those proceedings where the circuit courts have jurisdiction to decide rulemaking that is aside from a parent one case, and you could bring it in circuit court. And that's similar to what happened in the Heritage Credit Union case.
Doesn't 71-301-4A, though, doesn't that, I think that's the right statute that deals with the Tax Appeal Commission has, you know, the authority to enter into interpretations with regard to, you know, the tax matters generally.
Right. And again, prior to 1979, it said tax laws of the state, words to that effect, unless specifically accepted. In 79, they took that away and they put a set of enumerated statutes. And it's the income tax statutes, the sales tax statute, 70.995, council mentions, and a few other statutes, not 227.
Okay.
So that's why, the legislature really brought back, scaled down the authority of the Tax Appeals Commission in 1979 when it got rid of the general tax code or tax laws of the state and limited it to just those statutes. Otherwise, we've had excessive assessment actions that last for weeks and all that before circuit courts. So the circuit courts would love to have those sent to the Tax Appeals Commission. But thanks.
All right. Thank you very much. Interesting arguments.
Thank you very much.
Briefing, and the court will recess. Unfortunately, we're already 5 minutes late for our noon meeting, which is off premises. So we won't be out to talk with the students, but hopefully you enjoyed coming to court today, and we certainly enjoyed having you here. I'll just extend an invitation that if you have any particular questions that you would like to ask, give me a jingle and I'll try to answer it for you, okay? I'm easy to find if you just Google the number, okay? All right, take care.